Welcome to the Pitched Industries podcast.
Hey guys, what's going on? And welcome back to another episode of the Pitched Industries podcast. My name's Nick White, and for those of you who might be new to this podcast, this is where I sit down and have conversations with some of today's most successful creatives and ask them about how they've gotten to where they are today, things they've learned from their journey so far, advice they'd give aspiring creatives and students now, as well as a whole heap of other stuff. But before we jump into today's episode, I'd just like to quickly apologize to everyone regarding the large gap between last episodes. Over the last few weeks, I've had to slow things down a little bit as I've had a bunch of awesome brands and people reach out to me about jumping on board this podcast. So I've just had to slow it down for now before I really start ramping it up into next year. So I won't talk about this for too much now, but I'll definitely keep you all up to date with what's happening and everything via the Pitched Industries Instagram. So head over there if you have a chance. Today, I'm extremely excited to be sharing a conversation I had with the incredible Australian photographer, Adam Ferguson. If you are at all interested in conflict photography or have picked up a recent copy of Time magazine, I'm sure you would have come across some of Adam's work before. Adam's unique outlook on the world around him and how he often aims to challenge societal beliefs on particular issues makes him one of the most interesting photographers and authors around. For this reason, Adam's client list and publication list is impressive to say the least, with his work being featured on the front cover and inside publications like Time magazine, The New York Times magazine, National Geographic, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stones, and that's really just naming a few. There's so many others. On this episode, Adam and I talk about how he got into photography, what led him to document the US-led war in Afghanistan, misconceptions that people have about war, how he goes about pitching to publications, changes he's seen within the photography industry, and why he thinks being a photographer today isn't enough. So there's so many interesting things that Adam and I discuss in today's episode, and I'm sure that you're going to be able to get so much out of today's episode. So I won't talk for any longer. Let's get straight into this episode with Adam Ferguson. Adam, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for taking the time to be here today.
Nick, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so there's so many things that I'm wanting to discuss with you today, but before we jump into them, I'm pretty keen to just ask you a few short and sharp questions just to let the audience better get to know you, I suppose. Are you all good with that?
Yeah, fire away.
Sweet. So where do you currently call home?
I guess I would call New York home because my professional client base is there. I have a lot of friends there. I've been living there for the last 3 years. But I guess my spiritual homeland will always kind of be the Northern Rivers of New South Wales, kind of where I grew up.
Whose work do you admire the most currently?
I don't think there's a particular photographer or artist who I admire the most. I think I have a lot of respect for bodies of work more than I do individuals. I mean, the great documentary photographers have always been an influence, you know, James Nachtwey, Don McCullen, Sebastio Salgado. I mean, growing up as a young photographer, I definitely looked at that more traditional photographic reportage for inspiration. I think as I've like moved on in my career and got further down the road, I tend to try and not look at photography and more look at painting to inform my work.
Okay, that's interesting.
I think if you look at too much photography, there's a risk of mimicking it, and it becomes a little bit ingrained in your creative process. So and ultimately all photography references an earlier form of analog art. So that's definitely where I try and look at. I feel like it's more of an original voice to draw inspiration from, because most art has been bastardized in photography or appropriated at some point over time.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
There's a Belgian painter called Mikhail Barmans who does a lot of, you know, very interesting kind of portraiture. And in particular, he does these very kind of poignant portraits where he doesn't show people's faces. They're either looking away from the camera or they have something over their head. That's definitely been a big influence of mine as I've ended up coincidentally doing a lot of photographic portraiture in conflict over the last few years where I haven't been able to show the identity of people.
What's a favorite quote of yours that comes to mind?
You know, I can never remember who said this or where I read it, but there is a quote that's something along the lines of, "Photography is a lie that points to the truth." That's always really rung true for me.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. So what's your favorite thing to do in your own time?
Make pictures.
surprise, surprise.
You know, I think being a freelance photographer takes a lot, and to be honest, there doesn't seem a lot of time for anything else. I think being an independent photographer takes a lot of energy, and I feel like I'm kind of always on. Even if I am not on assignment, you know, every day it feels like there's things to do. So, yeah. You know, I'm a big surfer. I love to surf when I get time. You know, I've just had a week surfing kind of up the coast of New South Wales as a bit of downtime. But, you know, even in that, I'm, you know, making pictures and kind of working every day.
Yeah, nice. So what's a book that you would recommend?
I think On Photography by Susan Sontag is, you know, it's one of the classics. I think every photographer should have read that at some point just to get a sense of the manipulative, deceiving nature of photography, the power play that happens with making images. I think it's a must read for everybody.
The last one of the bunch now, and that is, if you could sit down and drink a beer and have a conversation with anyone in the entire world, past or present, who would that person be for you, and what beer would you be drinking?
I thought about this when you asked me. It's one of those questions. There's just so many people. I think it would have to be Jesus. I mean, you know, I kind of grew up in not a particularly religious family, but in a kind of Christian context. And, you know, I think going back to somebody that we, you know, look at as somebody that was enlightened at a pivotal time in history, I think it'd be really interesting to kind of get a sense of the mental process and his kind of outlook for humanity. It would also provide a pretty stark insight into the kind of the roots of religion and how they've been twisted over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, now we've gotten through those short and sharp questions, I'd kind of like to start us off today from the beginning. So can you talk to us a little bit about where your journey with photography started, and maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I think, you know, my photography career really started with a restlessness for wanting to travel, for wanting to see the world, for wanting to kind of understand my own position within the world. And I didn't really know how to do that, but I knew I wanted to get out of my hometown. I felt very stifled and frustrated as a young kid going to high school that was expected to make a career decision at the age of 18 and go to university and the whole kind of process we go through as young people. I remember feeling a lot of anger too. I was a very disillusioned teenager. You know, I felt angry with the state of kind of human civilization and the way it's very unsustainable, the way we kind of fight conflict. So I'd say it started there, but at that point I didn't know I wanted to be a photographer. Funnily enough, when I first picked up a camera, I thought I wanted to be a sports photographer. I'd met a friend of a friend. I was like, I think I was 19 years old in my hometown in Coffs Harbour. I was going nowhere fast, and I knew that I needed to get out. Otherwise, the outlook for me, I don't think, would have been great. I was, you know, doing drugs and carrying on as a young surfy punk does.
Yeah.
And I met a photographer, and we went skateboarding for a weekend, and he was taking all these photographs. He was a commercial photographer, and his name was John Rintoul, actually. And he was from Coffs Harbour, and he'd moved to Sydney and got into commercial photography. And I just had this epiphany that I could be a photographer and make images. It just seemed like a very kind of curious way of living, and that was very much in line with the way I felt and the way I wanted to exist in this world. I applied to the Queensland College of Art on a total whim. I didn't even own a camera. I grabbed my mother's camera. It was a Pentax K1000. I shot a portfolio in a day because I'd actually missed the cutoff for the Queensland College of Art that year, and I called them up. That was kind of back in the day before, I think, internet applications. And I got this lady on the phone that basically said, you know, she would, if I got my portfolio there, you know, by mid the next week, she would put it in the pile of applications because the lecturers hadn't reviewed them. So I grabbed my mum's camera. I shot a portfolio in a day. I paid like express processing at the local lab in Coffs Harbour and, you know, shipped off this portfolio and then kind of forgot about it and was planning to go overseas backpacking with my girlfriend at the time. And all of a sudden I got this letter in the mail from the Queensland College of Art telling me that I'd been accepted. And I just kind of knew that I had to go. So I broke up with the girl and I moved to Brisbane and turned up at art college, you know, with my mother's camera with a 50 mil lens on it. You know, I actually didn't even know I could take the lens off the camera. I didn't know what, you know, this was in the film days, like 2001 this was. I didn't know that films came in different speeds. I was just absolutely clueless. I remember this first day of, you know, art college, being there with everyone else, and everyone had some kind of photographic background. I remember just feeling so out of my depth. I was like, oh my God, this was a mistake. Like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I was, you know, didn't know the lingo, didn't know anything about it. But that was the start. That was the start for me.
Yeah. So looking back, how influential would you say your time studying photography at university was on your work?
It definitely didn't prepare me for the real world, but it was an incubator period. And, you know, for 3 years, I looked at photography, I read about photography, I studied art, and I think it was a very kind of good foundation to launch into the real world. I think there was something pure about not coming from a commercial background or kind of growing up as an assistant to a commercial photographer. It was really just about the work, the integrity of the work, and the meaning of the work. So I think that was a very valuable period. And I was very fortunate to have a couple of lecturers at Griffith University who were very influential to me, especially David Lloyd, who I had as my lecturer on my first big kind of practical project. And, you know, I didn't really know I wanted to be a documentary photographer at that time. But, you know, we all got sent out to shoot our first project, and everyone could really respond to that project however they wanted. And I ended up making documentary portraits of people all over Brisbane. I didn't really even know what I was doing or that I was necessarily making documentary work. But I kind of came back to class with this work, and I think David kind of saw something in that work and saw that I was passionate about it and wanted to continue in that vein. And I remember David sent me off to this library at, you know, the College of Art, and I looked at all these documentary books. I remember taking home a pile of them to my house that night, and I sat up till like 1 a.m. and one was a Don McCullen retrospective, one was Trent Park's Dream Life. I had a Cartier-Bresson kind of book of street photography in Paris. Had a couple of World Press photo annual books, and I remember just like looking at these books all night. I'd never looked at collections of documentary photography like this before, and I felt more inspired than I ever had in my entire life. And I knew at that moment that that's what I wanted to do and kind of what I needed to do. And it was that moment that I started on a path, and I relentlessly pursued it, and there's been no looking back.
I understand that after you finished university and really started jumping into photography, I suppose, you traveled to the Caribbean. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your travels were like through the Caribbean after you finished your photography studies?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the reason I went is kind of important. I finished art college at a really dire time in the media industry. So all I wanted to do was kind of get a job with the Sydney Morning Herald or work as an international photojournalist, and I couldn't get a job anywhere, which was a bit disillusioning. I couldn't even get a job at a regional newspaper. I remember applying for a job at the Lismore paper. I can't even remember the name of the paper right now, but you know, the main paper in Lismore. And I got very close to getting it, and I didn't get it. And looking back, it was a blessing in disguise, but at the time it was disillusioning. I just, you know, finished a degree, I was looking for a job, and I really couldn't get one. But I knew that I wanted to travel, and I knew that I wanted to work internationally and kind of participate in more international stories. So I knew that I kind of had to get out of Australia. One of my mates from my hometown had worked as a deckhand on a yacht that was in the Caribbean, and he was leaving that yacht. So it was a simple matter of like, well, I'm going to go be a deckhand. You know, I just graduated art college. I couldn't get a job. I had no money. So he put in a good word for me with his captain, and I had a chat to this boat captain on the phone, and I totally lied to him and told him I had all this boating experience I didn't have.
you got to do what you got to do.
But my mate had been a great deckhand and vouched for me, and you know, I knew my way around a dinghy and stuff like this. So and you know, Australians are pretty competent when it comes to the water, so I thought I'd be able to wing it. And I think I borrowed a flight ticket off my parents to get there, and I flew to the Caribbean and then spent a year working on this yacht. And we sailed from Antigua in the West Indies across the Panama, through the canal, up to Los Angeles, and then all the way back over the course of 12 months. And, you know, I saved enough money to buy a digital camera and a laptop and had a couple of grand to work on a try and work on a few stories independently. So I left the yacht and tried to be a photographer.
Yeah, that's cool. So before you moved over to work on the yacht, were you just getting work published at that time, or were you kind of just building your own personal portfolio?
I was getting a little bit of freelance work. I think I'd done a couple of jobs for the Herald. I did a couple of weeks work experience at the Herald.
Yep.
I'd done some freelance work in my hometown for the newspaper. So, but I wasn't getting published anywhere that significant, or I hadn't really worked on any significant stories. And looking back, I was a terrible photographer at that time in my career. I had a very kind of young, naive voice. I hadn't really found my own kind of visual language. I thought I was employable at time, but in hindsight, I really wasn't.
When did you feel you found your voice? I mean, you spoke about how you were quite a curious person growing up, and when did you really find the passion to document particular events? And were you thinking about what you might be able to document during your travels through the Caribbean?
Oh man, I think I'm still looking for my voice.
Yeah.
it's a funny thing, like trying to recognize your own voice. I think as a photographer or any form of author, I'm sure grapples with. And, you know, I don't know what it is. I think if you understand your own voice too much, you can probably strangle it. I think it's got to be something that's largely intuitive. There's a real delicate balance that has to happen there. I mean, the ideal, I think, for any photographer is that other people look at your work and go, you know, they know that that photograph was taken by this person because there's a certain stamp on it. It's an intangible stamp, but, you know, I can think of a lot of photographers when I see their pictures exhibited or in a magazine, like I know it's their work before looking at the byline. And I think that's the ideal. You want to have something to contribute that's a slightly original and unique voice. And God, it's almost an impossible thing to conceptualize yourself. I don't know if I've ever really got that yet. Maybe, maybe not. I guess it's for an audience to judge.
What did you then do after leaving the yacht?
Man, like I spent a whole year working on this yacht and was restless the whole time because all I wanted to do was be a photographer. I was desperate to be a photographer. And I knew that I wanted to be a war photographer. From a very early age, I knew that I wanted to photograph conflict. But we can go into why that was a little later in our chat. But When I left this yacht, I found an NGO that had a midwifery program in central Mexico. And I'd spent a lot of time sailing the coast of Mexico, so I'd developed a fascination with the country. So I left the yacht and ended up moving to this little town in Guanajuato called San Miguel de Allende. And I spent 3 months living in this little town, and I ended up contributing to the local newspaper. I worked on a couple of features for American magazines. And I made enough money to kind of survive. But eventually it wasn't enough money, and I ran out. And
yeah,
I went back to being a deckhand again. So I kind of gave it a shot as a freelancer. I was a little bit successful. I definitely made some money and had some good experiences, but it wasn't enough. And then I flew to the Mediterranean and got a job on another yacht and worked for 4 months for a season working as a deckhand again. And again, just frustrated the whole time. All I, you know, every day out there kind of, you know, working. Even though I was in beautiful places and I was on like luxury yachts, I just so desperately wanted to be a photographer. But working in the Mediterranean was much more profitable than the first yacht that I worked on. So I think I managed to save, you know, $20,000 in 3 or 4 months. And
wow.
And I used that money to then do an internship. So I left the yard and I scored an internship at Seven Photo Agency, which had an office at the time in Paris, and, you know, represented a lot of contract photographers who work for National Geographic and Time Magazine and all the dominant American magazines. And
yep.
I had 3 months as an internship there. And I think that's where I really got my professional footing. You know, I had this kind of ideological foundation from art college, but I didn't really know how to go out there and function professionally. I was clueless. And all of a sudden, yeah, being an intern at this photo agency, I picked up simple things about, you know, how to approach editors, you know, how to do expenses, how to like do all this just practical logistical stuff, which working traveling photographers need to do function and survive. And it also gave me a very healthy address book. You know, I was a young intern at this photo agency that worked for all the big photo editors. So when I left that photo agency 3 months later, I had the contact details for every kind of significant photo editor in the industry. And I moved to India and was able to email all those people and go, hey, you know, I'm Adam. I was the intern and now I'm trying to be a photographer in my own right. And, you know, it was a slow burn when I first moved to India in 2007. But, you know, some of those people responded. And I think everyone wants to get behind somebody that's kind of young and aspiring and passionate and prepared to give it a go. And that's definitely what I was doing when I moved to India. And, you know, slowly but surely, I started to pick up a few assignments.
Yeah. So these assignments, were they certain ideas that you had to pitch to potential magazines or clients? And if so, how did you go about doing that?
Most of the assignments that I got in India that were my bread and butter were, they weren't my ideas. They were very small newspaper or magazine assignments that would generally come out of a photo editor knowing I was in India because I'd emailed them and I told them I was working in India. So they'd start to give me short, you know, it was a thing where the photographer they'd had been using for the last 6 months or 12 months wasn't available. So they're like, oh, we'll use that new guy and give him a shot and give me like, you know, pretty small, like 1 day shoots or, you know, make a portrait for a story, this kind of stuff. It was all pretty boring, to be honest. I did a lot for Bloomberg Newswire at the time, and they would send me along to photograph press conferences where business people would announce like their financial results in five-star hotels, like this kind of stuff. But it was all enough for me to pay my way and then help me work on my own stuff. So the first few stories I did in India, I did self-funded. I used the money from the boring assignments to go and work on projects. And then I would use that work to show the editors that I wanted to be working for, like the editors at Time Magazine and National Geographic and, you know, these bigger, better magazines, and I would show that work to them. And, you know, slowly but surely, you know, my work kind of got a bit better and I started to land, you know, bigger assignments. But I think it's very important to be pitching work. I mean, early in my career, it was also a different time in the editorial industry.
Yeah.
Back then, I mean, the editorial industry isn't as robust anymore. So I think as a photographer right now, it's very important to be pitching stuff. I've found myself pitching more and more lately. I definitely get photo editors that will know that I'm covering a certain issue or topic or region, and they'll reach out and be like, you know, what do you want to do in that region? Have you got some ideas? So I think the days of sitting back and, you know, waiting for editors to give you a call and offer you an assignment are well and truly over.
Yeah. That's really interesting because it's something which I've been thinking about a lot recently, and it seems like there's so many people getting into photography now that, yeah, you really do need to start pushing your work and ideas out to people. I suppose in some respects, there's never been a need for more images than right now. I mean, there's so many new news outlets and people that are wanting imagery, but I suppose it's just all about, yeah, getting your work in front of them rather than letting them find you or someone else, I suppose.
Absolutely. And Instagram has been an incredible tool, or I should say Instagram is an incredible tool to do that. I think every photographer now has the power to be able to curate and push their own career through social media. As recently as 10 years ago, you couldn't really do that. You really had to get in front of people with a hard copy portfolio. And I think there is still validity to doing that, but Instagram has really given everybody the freedom of expression that they need to really make the work that they want to and help refine their own vision and put it straight out there into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I definitely want to touch on changes which you might have seen within the industry moving forward. But before we get into all that stuff, I'm really interested to ask you a little bit about what led you to document the US-led war in Afghanistan.
From the moment I discovered photography, and in particular conflict photography, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. There was just something inside me that clicked and I felt like I wanted to go. When I was kind of coming of age as a photographer, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were at their heights. I'd marched in anti-Iraq rallies when I was at art college. And I also had a history of conflict. My grandfather had served in World War II. And I had a fascination with war. Like every nation state on the planet has been formed out of war or conflict. So I felt a slight dilemma with it. I wanted to understand it. I wanted to participate in the dialogue around war, but I definitely didn't want to be a combatant and felt quite anti-war. So going as a photographer was this middle zone of me being able to kind of reconcile my understanding of war and also participate in the conversation around it, which I think is a very important conversation. So that's why I originally made the decision to go to Afghanistan. The first time I went on a self-funded trip. I was living in India and had been cultivating my career there. And, you know, I just kind of knew it was time to go. So I bought body armor and a helmet, and it was an hour and a half flight between Delhi and Kabul on a civilian flight at the time. So I bought a ticket, and I really didn't know what to expect when I got there. I wasn't sure how intense it was going to be. I wasn't sure if I'd, walk out of the airport and there was kind of rockets flying through the sky and bombs going up. I was completely naive. But I had a couple of contacts, friends of friends, other photographers, a few journalists who were friends of friends. So I just got there and kind of made sense of it. The other photographers I hung out with taught me a lot. I just kind of fell into the fold of going out, working with other friends and colleagues, which was super important. And then I started to get a few small assignments while I was there, which ended up kind of paying for the trip. And then I went back to Delhi a couple of weeks later and knew that I'd discovered something that there was no turning back from. I wanted to just go back and keep working. It felt like the most significant war of my time. Afghanistan fascinated me as a country, this kind of remote battleground, which has seen so many conflicts over the years and been the intersection of like these geopolitical struggles. I was just enthralled by it and really wanted to participate in that conversation. So I kind of made that my all for the next few years. And that's really where my career took off.
What did you want to achieve when you bought that ticket to Afghanistan? I mean, you spoke about how you wanted to participate in some way and really understand what war was, I suppose. But how did you want to influence people with your photography?
I think ultimately I wanted to be an anti-war photographer. It became very clear to me when I went to Afghanistan that we were fighting a misguided war.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda or bin Laden had, bombed America on 9/11, and it had stimulated this attack on Afghanistan to chase this terrorist network, which really wasn't intrinsic to the country's political or cultural fabric. Yet there'd been this huge international invasion. Al-Qaeda had run away. They deposed the Taliban and maintained this kind of presence there, fighting this war with no particular aim. And it became very clear to me that, Afghanistan is a very kind of tribal, fractured country anyway. And you have a bunch of troops there kind of as a pretty imperial presence. And the war there was never going to be won by, imposing on all these different kind of tribes people. We're talking about, these futuristic almost American soldiers in their night vision and helmets, patrolling through villages with mud houses that have existed the same way for thousands of years. And there was a total mismatch between the aims of the international coalition led by the Americans and the reality on the ground. I mean, I really didn't see these people out there as terrorists who were out there fighting every day. They were really local tribespeople who would, shoot at anyone that walked into their village. If the neighboring tribe kind of came into their turf, they would probably have a gunfight. So I think the narrative around the whole war got very confused, and I wanted to make pictures which somehow challenged this. I wanted to talk about the disillusionment of the young American soldiers in this war, which I really felt when I got out into the remote areas of it. Yeah. I wanted to present the Afghans in a more complex way by kind of trying to deconstruct this kind of notion of terrorists, because I really didn't see true terrorism when I was out on patrol in this place.
How involved are you with what's happening around you? Are you a piece of the puzzle, or are you a fly on the wall in these situations?
I mean, you try and be a fly on the wall, I think, is the ideal when you especially if I'm on assignment for a magazine and theoretically working as a photojournalist. You have a responsibility to try and be a fly on the wall and make something which, the integrity of every scene needs to exist without you. But, it's a very complicated situation every time. I mean, being there with a camera definitely impacts some of the situations and scenes that you witness. You influence people's behavior, people perform for the camera. So, you can never really be this objective observer. You're a participant in most instances, I think.
It's crazy to think that you were just in India. You kind of just packed your bags, bought all this armor and then went to Afghanistan to kind of document this whole war. I mean, traveling to a war zone obviously comes with its risks. How did you overcome the fear associated with these risks if you were experiencing them at all at that stage?
Yeah, when I look back, actually, and now we're talking about it, it seems like a totally ridiculous thing to do. And I was, you know, young and naive and ambitious. I'm not sure why the hell I did that. but something drove me to. I'm not that brave anymore, to be honest. But I don't remember feeling fear. I was very passionate about the story, and I wanted to create documents that told that story about that place at that point in time. I felt like it was very important to do so. And I was also young and ambitious. I was building a career. I wanted to make it. I wanted to be successful. And I think that was part of it, which is not the most noble motivation, to be honest. But, you know, I think any professional that kind of works in that sphere, that's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, it's kind of like 50% ambition and 50% nobility. I mean, I'd never be one of these photographers that would say, oh, you know, I'm just purely driven because I have this overarching kind of social conscience and I want to save the world. Yeah, you know, I want to make stories that have a positive impact for sure. But all humans are driven by ambition as well. And I think that was part of being a young photographer that wanted to rush off to a war zone.
It's funny how you spoke, how you didn't really experience fear. I mean, why do you think that was?
I definitely felt a sense of do or die. I didn't have a lot of money. I was out there in the world. I'd chosen this career. I felt like there was no room to fail. There was no backup plan. I wasn't going to come back to Australia and not succeed, you know? So I think that drove me, and somehow that overcome my fear. I think just being a kind of young, more volatile, energy-fueled man made me have less fear than I probably do today. I find when I work currently, I'm much more kind of considered in the way that I work, and I definitely evaluate risk to a higher degree than I did. Not as gung-ho as I used to be.
Do you think that's because of things you've seen or just getting older, I suppose?
I think it's probably a mix of things I've seen. I think I approach stories a little more intelligently than I used to, and probably just a bit older and wiser, I hope.
Yeah. Do you think that the things you've seen in Afghanistan and the things you've documented has really had an effect on the way you view the world and its happenings around you?
Yes, they have for sure. It's a hard question to answer, actually. I've seen some horrific things over the years, and they have no doubt impacted my position in the world and my reality and sense of belonging in the world. I don't think I've totally made sense of everything that I've seen, to be honest. I mean, I think I probably have to answer that question in another 20 years.
Yeah. Do things keep you up at night? I mean, have you become good at really blocking out what you see there? Do you not read into things? I mean, it's kind of like I've seen a lot of your work and you really have seen some pretty intense things. I mean, how do you go about dealing with that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we all have a capacity for trauma, and I think I have a decent capacity for trauma. You know, I've never had a nightmare. I've never woken up in the middle of the night thinking about, you know, some crazy thing that I've seen. So none of my experiences have really come back to haunt me, and I don't have, you know, I guess what you'd call clinical post-traumatic stress. And I feel very fortunate not to. I know colleagues that have had a really tough time with some of the things that they've experienced, and it's not an easy road to navigate. I've read a lot about trauma and how humans process it, and the reality is we all have a capacity for trauma, but we don't really know how large that capacity is. So, you know, I could go and see another 5 years worth of carnage and maybe be fine, but I could see one more thing and something could flick inside my head and all of a sudden I have what they call post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah. I've never been a photographer that has tried to back up assignments too quick, and I haven't covered every war on the planet over the last, you know, decade of my career. I've tried to be a bit more considered, and you know, I chew off what I feel like I can process, take some time, and when I'm ready, I'll work again. And I think that's worked for me, that mode of working. If I was brutally honest, I think that probably a little quieter than I used to be, slightly more introverted, I would say, but, you know, not to an extreme level, but I think that is probably how it's affected me somewhat. It really just, you know, when you see people suffer and you come really close to death, I think it really makes you take a step back and just contemplate a bit more and, you know, feel a bit grateful for what you have and be less assertive and aggressive about the way you move through the world.
Yeah, yeah. So how many times would you say you've been in these experiences? That sounds pretty hectic.
I mean, I've been in a helicopter crash. I've been shot at. I mean, I've lost count how many times I've been shot at.
Yeah.
I've been in a car crash. I don't know. There's been a lot of times where I've had some pretty near misses.
Mm.
Yeah.
Putting yourself in these life-threatening situations, I mean, obviously gives you a whole heap of adrenaline and it's kind of like a huge rush. I suppose it's something you could probably say similar to doing an extreme sport almost. Do you feel like you're addicted to that rush? Do you get bored with photographing anything that isn't conflict photography now?
You know, Nick, I don't anymore, but I think early in my career there was a certain amount of addiction to the work. I didn't recognize it at the time, but I remember friends pointed it out. You know, I would do this thing or I'd go and do this intense trip with the military in Afghanistan and I would come out so exhausted and tired and say that I would, you know, I was never going to go back and do that again. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I'd be back on a plane to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So there definitely was this kind of, you know, pattern that we've, you know, seen discussed in being a foreign correspondent and doing this kind of work. And I'm not ashamed to say that was definitely happening to me in hindsight. It's not really how I work anymore. I've grown out of that. And I think it's for the better. I think my work is better actually having grown out of it. I was in Afghanistan a few weeks ago and, you know, I wasn't doing anything kind of crazy, but it was risky in some areas. You know, the security in Afghanistan really isn't good at the moment. And, you know, I found myself not liking being there. You know, to be honest, I kind of couldn't wait to leave. And I was making very calculated decisions about everything that I did. So I think I've grown out of this mode of feeling addicted to the work or needing that rush. I think the way I approach photographing now is very different. It's much more considered and I'm trying to do it in a way where I'm actually not running out and putting myself in harm's way.
Yeah.
I think the work that you make doing that is limited anyway at this point in time. I mean, there's only so much a picture of a soldier or a combatant in a gunfight can really, really tell us. And I think it's the behind the scenes images, which are much more insightful when it comes to war.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, looking at your photos, it's definitely, yeah, the photos that you've captured of soldiers, not really in these conflict situations, but maybe it's just their expressions in their body language or face. I mean, those images really seem to carry a lot of weight.
Yeah. I think while I covered the war in Afghanistan, I started to get very disillusioned, actually, because, you know, as I mentioned before, I felt like I was there as ultimately like an anti-war photographer. And when I would see my pictures being used in, you know, kind of mainstream narratives in the media, especially in the US press, even if the story of the work wasn't pro-war, it still kind of was in a way. You know, this kind of industrial military complex is so pervasive that any picture of a soldier, negative or positive, still somehow kind of supported a sympathy. I remember, you know, this particular period while I was covering Afghanistan in about 2010, where I was getting emails from military service people or the wives of service people after they'd seen my work and tell me, you know, how inspiring it was and how they thought it was great that I was out there covering the war and, you know, thank you for my hard work, this kind of stuff. And I remember having this moment where I was like, I felt very conflicted about it because the work that I was trying to do was, you know, supposed to stimulate a more complex, constructive dialogue. It was supposed to be slightly critical, but it was being perceived as glorifying. And I remember really struggling with that at the time. And I kind of thought, well, it doesn't really matter what pictures I make. You know, once you isolate a single picture and, you know, put it out there, you know, these photographs have a life of their own and I don't really control the narrative. You know, it's impossible for a single photograph to have a narrative. I mean, a collection of pictures can have a more nuanced narrative, but one photograph on its own is it's this polyvalent creature and anyone can bring their own interpretation to it. And yeah. I started to feel like a bit of a participant. You know, I found myself getting embeds because I was a Time magazine photographer and the company wanted me to come out because, you know, they wanted their unit of guys to be in Time magazine kind of stuff. And then I really kind of at that point withdrew from that work a bit because I started to feel very disillusioned about my own role in the conversation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, one thing which I suppose sort of relates and I want to touch on is doing the research on you before having this chat with you today. I mean, in a past interview, you spoke about how often people think that war is a high energy place when in fact it most of the time isn't. What are some misconceptions that you believe people have about war today?
I think the majority of people's perceptions around war, definitely like, you know, when we're talking about a relatively mainstream audience, come from Hollywood films. And they definitely create this sense of heightened drama, combat. And it's really not like that when you get out there. Like I would spend days, sometimes a week, you know, sitting around a military base with not really much going on. And then all of a sudden, there'd be this kind of heightened incident. You know, you'd be bored out of your mind. Everyone else is bored. It's hot. And then all of a sudden you go on patrol and somebody gets shot or a bomb goes off or something. So I was always interested in this notion of war is boring.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to taking risks before and, you know, being addicted to that, you know, when I look back through my work now and I'm in the process of compiling this collection of photographs from my time in Afghanistan in a monograph, the photographs that I'm selecting aren't necessarily the moments of this heightened drama or incident. They're not really the gunfights. They're either, if they are at the gunfight, it's a picture looking away from the actual fighting, or it's the in-between moments. It's the downtime of some young soldier kind of sitting on his bed or having a reaction, or it's a landscape that shows everything actually outside the drama.
Do you think that's because they're parts that you might relate with the most?
Yeah, I think I do relate to those photographs more now. I also just, I guess in a way, like kind of when I'm editing my work now, I'm trying to right a wrong, if that makes sense. And I think these photographs that I'm choosing, or the photographs of kind of quieter moments, tell a more complex, unexpected story about the war. We don't really need to see pictures of people having glorious gunfights. It doesn't really further our understanding of conflict or the war in Afghanistan.
I'm really excited and interested to see this series of images you're putting together. So, yeah, make sure you let us know when all that's done and, yeah, love to have a look at it. But I suppose So I suppose this is as good a time as any to ask you to talk a little bit about your creative process.
I think my creative process has followed an arc within my career that is a little in line with some of the other things that I've talked about. And I think early in my career, it was very reactive. You know, I'd run into situations with a camera, I would be assigned a story, or I'd go out and work on a project. And I was really just, you know, making as many pictures as I could without really thinking too hard about what they meant. I was just somehow trying to make a good image. I think I looked at a lot of other photographers' work, and I think early in my career definitely mimicked a lot of other photographers. I think every young photographer does this to a certain degree, and it's kind of part of growing up, I think. Yeah. So it was both reactive and trying to replicate other languages that I'd seen as successful, which in some ways was a mistake, but it was also like just part of my journey. I think now when I go out and work on a project, I take a much more considered, thoughtful approach. I take a long look at the things I'm going out to photograph. I definitely look at the way they've been photographed before, but not to get ideas about how to photograph them, more to get ideas how not to photograph them. I think as I kind of get further along my career, I'm definitely more interested in making work that challenges the narratives around issues instead of like reinforces, you know, other ideas or other images. And to go back to the conversation about painting that we had earlier in our chat, I definitely look at painting. I try and take ideas from historical artworks and somehow infuse them into modern representations. And I do this as a deliberate kind of hat tilt you know, I don't feel like I'm stealing ideas and not trying to acknowledge the fact that I'm appropriating stuff. But I think with medium of photography, it's impossible not to appropriate. You know, you appropriate even if you don't know you're doing it, because pictures have become such a vernacular part of our existence.
Yeah.
And everything replicated in photography had a history in painting, whether it's color or pose or whatever. So my approach now is more to like very deliberately acknowledge my influences, rather than try and mimic something I've seen before mindlessly.
Yeah, it's really interesting how you said you look at other work around an idea to understand how not to shoot something. I mean, that's a really interesting, cool concept, I reckon.
Yeah, it's also, you know, I think in this kind of day and age, it's becoming increasingly harder, I think, to work as a photographer. Everyone's a photographer now. You know, it doesn't matter whether you exist in the documentary space, the art world, or the commercial space. You know, everyone's taking pictures, the budgets aren't there like they used to be. I mean, the only currency I think you have as a photographer is to be an author and kind of have something to say.
Yeah.
So I think for me, having a more considered approach is A, trying to like kind of separate myself from what everyone else is doing, and also make work that is more meaningful and valid intellectually and conceptually.
Yeah. So obviously we'll talk a little bit more about that moving forward, but I want to ask you, is there a process of how you go about generating ideas for a new series of work?
Yeah. When a project comes to me, or I have the idea for one, I definitely read about the place or the people or the phenomenon. I think that's definitely where my initial ideas come from. And then I often look at the information around that topic to get a sense of how it's being portrayed before. I really try and build up like a kind of landscape in my mind that is informed by both literature, fiction, other imagery and art to get a sense of how this idea or this concept fits within a broader narrative. And I let all that kind of fuel my own development of a position about that. I don't think I'm an objective storyteller. You know, there's been a concept for a lot of years that, you know, documentary photography records, you know, some semblance of truth, or, you know, it's a mirror of reality, which of course isn't true. So I definitely, I use these different tools to try and understand a story to a point where I can kind of develop my own fiction around it.
Yeah.
And somehow have a bias and have something to say. And then I really try and kind of harness that intellectually and infuse it into the photography.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what would you say documentary photography is then, if it's not a mirror of reality?
Documentary photography is a bit like a poem. It's an impression of a space at a time of a people. It's there's so much that goes into it. You know, you choose a moment. You know, you choose to work in color or black and white. You know, you choose your exposure. There's so many effects, so to speak, that go into photography that it's really, I think it's a very impressionistic medium. So it's not to be confused with anything that is a semblance of reality. It's a very kind of biased interpretation of the world.
So when you're generating these ideas for a new series of work and laying it all out in front of you and really trying to understand and form your own perspective or opinion on the idea that you might be wanting to document, do you leave your mind open to photographing things that might go against the opinion that you've made?
I mean, absolutely. And kind of every time, to be honest. I feel like the intuitive happy accidents or the things that are spontaneous are often the most successful creations. So I'm always open to, you know, a divergence from the plan. I think it's, you know, to just strip that back to, say, a portrait sitting, and I find myself doing a lot of portraits lately. Whenever I have a portrait sitting, I have a lighting concept in mind. I have the idea about how I'm going to pose the subject. But, you know, it's always like it's a plan and it's a base, and then I always let it develop out of that base. I think it's important to have plan and a bit of structure to start with, but then I think it's fundamental to let things like unfold and see what happens. You never know what a subject is going to kind of bring to the situation. And I think there has to be room in that, otherwise you kind of strangle something which has a life of its own.
Yeah.
But just to wind it back a little bit, I mean, you know, with what I was talking about, you know, how do I conceptualize a shoot? I mean, I did a portrait series in Nigeria a couple of years ago now on this group of young women who were young Nigerian women that were kidnapped from their villages, trained as suicide bombers by Boko Haram, the local insurgency in the area of northern Nigeria, and then sent out to blow themselves up. Like, they literally had suicide vests strapped to them. They were deployed by militants. And instead of blowing themselves up, they turned themselves in and, you know, survived this, you know, horrific experience. So I could, for these girls' own security, I knew that I couldn't show their identities. So I went into this situation knowing I was doing a series of portraits. I couldn't show the faces of the girls, but I had to come out with something that was kind of strong and impactful. So I ended up looking at a mix of like fashion photography and contemporary painting where you couldn't see the identities of the subjects. I looked at the painting because I wanted the pictures to feel surreal and beautiful. I wanted us to somehow feel like we were abstracted from reality, because I think that the experience these girls had was, you know, it was so fraught and so beyond the reality they'd had in their village life for years that I thought it was an interesting parallel. The other thing I wanted to do was make these girls look beautiful, which is why I looked at a lot of fashion work, because, and this comes back to me trying to like make images which are counter to the narrative that already exists around something. I mean, I looked at a lot of images that have been made in Nigeria over the years, which kind of reinforce poverty. Especially poverty around like marginalized Africans. So I tried to make these girls look deliberately beautiful. I tried to make them look surreal. I tried to make them look empowered, and I tried to make them look beautiful. And to me, that was kind of constructing something which was important. It served the voices of the individuals I was photographing, and it was something that was different to anything I'd seen out there. So that was kind of part of the process. So I actually, for the first time ever, actually, I drew pictures. I Frankenstein different poses from fashion images, from painting that I'd seen, and I sketched a set of 10 photographs that then I kind of replicated when I got to Nigeria, you know, in this little town in the north of the country to photograph. That's an example of how I've kind of worked recently when it comes to kind of portraiture that's a bit more considered and less reactive.
I'm really interested to ask you a few things regarding perspective now and how that influences your work. Your work from a visual standpoint is incredible, but the thing is, I believe that your photos carry so much more weight because of the stories or issues that revolve around them. I mean, things similar to the series you just spoke about. When you're sent on assignment to photograph a particular idea or issue, how do you prevent your personal opinions influencing how you photograph it?
I mean, I think we almost got to this before, but I think it's a great question. I want my personal opinions to be voiced. I think the best work, whether it's photography or film or literature, has an opinion. I mean, that's what people relate to. That's what people find interesting. So I think in every one of these situations I go into, I try and put my stamp on it. I try and have a voice. I mean, the other side of that is I'm also just a messenger. I mean, you know, as you said, these Nigerian women, for example, have such a powerful story. I never want to kind of overpower that. I mean, all I can do is try and present it. And it's the responsibility of the photographer or storyteller to try and present it in a way that somehow complements the phenomenon or the trauma or the experience and kind of bring it to light. But in doing that, I think the bias that I have is kind of the only currency I have and the only really qualification I have to tell that story is to somehow, you know, put my take on it.
Yeah. Do you worry at times that what you photograph may misrepresent what's actually happening?
Nick, it's a good question and a very complicated question. I do worry about it, but I think images tend to have a life of their own and you can't really control that. People are going to bring their own perceptions to stories. Like I was in Hong Kong recently photographing the protests there. And, you know, there's so many sides to that argument. You know, there's definitely there's an anti-Chinese sentiment in the West. So people tend to rally behind the Chinese protesters a little bit more than they would if they weren't fighting this authoritarian superpower.
So
your images, you know, when photographing kind of political events that, you know, have this very complex kind of geopolitical saga around them, it's kind of, it's really impossible to dictate how they're going to be perceived by an audience. I mean, the images appear in magazines or on the internet, and they really have a life of their own. I think the only way really to, you know, to really control a conversation or to build your own narrative, which is much tighter, is to exhibit collections of works or publish books or, you know, really craft something which is your own. I think when a photograph appears in the media, it can really, there's a whole number of ways it can be interpreted, and there's various repercussions or interpretations of the image.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose that's kind of what makes photos so powerful. I mean, like the way that people can look at them from their own personal standpoint and have a completely different view on an image to maybe the person next to them. It's quite interesting. Are there any photographs that stand out for you which have really had an impact on the way you try and go about your photography work?
I made a picture in Afghanistan, I think it was in 2009, of a US Army infantry soldier looking through what's called a long-range acquisition site, basically like a, you know, a big thermal camera where he can, like, you know, spy on villages at nighttime.
Yeah.
And you know, see what's going on. It was a very quiet moment. I made it at night in really crappy light, and I think my exposure was 2 or 3 seconds, and I kind of balanced on this, I balanced on a pole and made this image. I didn't really think about it at the time. I didn't think that I'd made a particularly interesting image or something that would be published much. It was just an image I made kind of pretty mindlessly, actually. And that image ended up becoming, I think, one of the most successful images from Afghanistan, and it was received well and published a lot. And I think this picture was successful and made me reflect on my own work a lot, because it was a quiet image of a guy sitting on a hill looking through a scope, but all of a sudden this quiet moment became a metaphor for the larger conflict. It was this young man looking at this enemy who they would never actually meet or have hand-to-hand combat with. So it became this metaphor of this kind of technological distant war that was being fought. It was almost like this guy was playing a video game, even though it was very quiet. And I didn't realize it at the time, but later when I started to reflect on that photograph, it made me understand something about my own work. And that is, I think, you know, the best photography doesn't necessarily serve you this kind of two-dimensional anecdote. It's something which alludes to a bigger picture. It's a metaphor for something else. It speaks to a larger kind of archetype about the phenomenon which is happening inside the photograph. And I think the best images ask us to think about things beyond the photograph, not just what's inside the photographic frame.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. For someone who's spent so much time in conflict and photographing war, what is your perspective of war?
I don't think we should fight wars, but that is a very idealistic position. I think our societies and the militaries inherent to those societies have, you know, evolved and developed to a point where we have these, you know, military structures in place to, you know, regulate law and order and to maintain our borders and sense of states and all the rest of it. And I think at this point in time, they're very archaic institutions, and I don't think there's any room in this world for overt violence. That's what I think about war. We should stop fighting them. But, you know, that's easier said than done, of course. It's a very complicated conversation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's, I think we could probably make a whole podcast episode on that question alone.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I recently returned to Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan last month. You know, and I hadn't been for a few years, and it struck me what a crazy, convoluted fight that's going on there now. I mean, you know, after the international occupation led by the US for so many years, or, you know, it's still going on there in a very scaled down measure. You know, we have Afghan national forces fighting US forces, fighting the Taliban, you know, and now fighting, you know, ISIS affiliates, which is just insane. It's almost like this kind of 3-4-way conflict.
It's
hard to even fathom how the country could end up like this when you look at the, I think it was $150 billion that's been spent on Afghanistan.
And it's crazy.
It really brings deep disillusion to somebody that has covered that story, because that war didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huge amounts of money was spent. You could have rebuilt the entire country for that kind of money. Yet we spent a lot of money on infrastructure that was never finished. A lot of money was lost through corruption, and a lot of money was spent on, you know, the military apparatus, and it didn't work. That country is in a worse position than it was under Taliban rule, really.
Yeah. It's hard at times to really see what's happening there and why they're there, in my personal opinion. Like, it's definitely not a clear cut thing for me.
Yeah, it's really not. And, you know, we could talk about this for hours, but it's not clear cut. I had this really interesting experience on the recent trip to Afghanistan that I was talking about, where I went up to the northeast of the country, an area called Kuno province, where the Americans took some of their heaviest losses, you know, during the height of the Afghan war in like 2000, kind of, you know, 8, 9, 10. And there was a bunch of Afghans who had surrendered to the local police. Now, these guys were ultimately like a platoon of soldiers who had been Taliban, who had fought American forces. And then when America withdrew from that area, ISIS affiliates moved in. Then they became ISIS. And then they realized they were fighting other Afghans. And then they surrendered to the local police. So these are like,
wow,
you know, local villagers who have done this full arc. They'd fought the Americans. Their dads had probably fought the Russians.
Yeah.
Then they joined ISIS. Then they realized ISIS, you know, they didn't like ISIS, and they were just like fighting with their brothers, and they surrendered. And I sat in this guest house in Kunar and hung out with these guys. The commander was a mullah, and, you know, was singing. They're all the most respectful, polite guys. And I kind of had this conversation with them, because all of a sudden I was sitting in this room with these guys. I had no, you know, there was security on the gate of the guest house, but, you know, I had no police or security in the room with me.
Yeah.
And I'm literally sitting down with people who were probably shooting at the Americans when I used to go out on patrol with them in that area.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, tell me, like, you know, I was just so interested to hear about their ideology. And they were just kind of like, they're like, of course we fought the Americans. Like, it was a dishonor not to. Like, this is our valley, you know, our tribe has had this area for as, you know, long as we can remember and our fathers can remember. Mm. When the Americans invaded in 2001, you know, the commander's father was killed by American forces. So it was like, we fight. Like, they basically said, if we don't fight, we're losers. Like, it's dishonorable. And I was just sitting there with these people who we think about as these evil terrorists, but all of a sudden I was in their mindset.
Yeah.
And I was like, they're just regular guys, you know?
Yeah.
They live in a place, and that's kind of what they have to do.
Yeah, and I'm sure Australians would probably do a very, very similar thing if someone else came here.
Yes, exactly. And as would, you know, any American living in a provincial part of the country if there was a foreign invader kind of coming in.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So I feel like we should probably move on from war, because, yeah, we could talk about this all day, I think. But I want to ask you a few of the regular questions that I ask a lot of people that come on this show. And I want to start off by asking, can you tell me about the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
I think the best piece of advice I've received was from a colleague who just told me to make my own pitches. And again, I think I kind of mentioned this slightly before, but I think it's, you know, young photographers look around at all the other work that's being done and people that are successful. And I think there's a inherent kind of nature to try and copy what's been done before you, and, you know, that's kind of a path to success. But, you know, I think the best thing to do is really to find your own groove and to make your own pictures. You know, you don't have to do anything that looks like anyone else's work.
Yeah, if you want to stand out today, you really have to start doing that.
I think you do. The only thing you really have is your own voice and your own vision. I mean, you have to have something to say, and if you don't have anything to say, you're just another photographer.
Yeah. Is there anything in the past that you feel has held you back, or that you would change to kind of, I don't know, fast line your success or skip doing, looking back in hindsight?
Oh God, there's a bunch. that piece of advice that was given to me, I think I'd follow that harder.
Yeah.
If I had my time again, I think I was perhaps a slow learner as a young photographer. And I mean, if I had my time again, I'd be a lot more fearless about the way I worked. And yeah. I really wouldn't care what other people thought. When I say that, I don't mean, you know, be lazy or reckless with the decisions you make. I think you have to be a professional and you need to be very serious about your craft and the concepts you instill into it and the whole business around being a photographer or an author. But if I could have my time again, I would just be absolutely fearless. Funnily enough, I hit a point in my career a few years ago where I got very disillusioned with photography. You know, I felt like I wasn't enjoying it anymore. I felt like the journey was a bit exhausting. I felt a bit disillusioned from, you know, covering a lot of conflict and not feeling like there was enough positive impact from that work. And also just feeling like, you know, the business takes a lot, you know, it's getting harder to work as a freelancer. And I was just like, what is all this for? And I was kind of ready to give up, to be honest. And within that, I started to be really reckless. I started to be like, well, I actually don't care if this person ever calls me again.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to do exactly what I want to do. I'm going to own it like I never have before. I'm going to make risky creative decisions. I'm going to do something they don't expect me to do. And I'm going to have more fun with this and be more experimental.
Yeah.
And feel like I'm going to do something that's totally mine. And I just, you know, I still had a responsibility to the subject to try and do something as best I could and work hard, but I was prepared to take risks that I'd never taken before. And funnily enough, in doing that, I probably made the best work I've ever made and everyone loved it.
Yeah.
And that editor has hired me a lot more since then. I think the moral to that story is you've got to be ready to make mistakes. You've got to be fearless in the way you establish your own voice as a photographer. And I think that means, you know, not just in documentary, or I think it doesn't matter what you do, like whether it doesn't matter whether you're a wedding photographer or a commercial photographer, an artist, or whatever you identify as. I think you've got to be ready to separate yourself from the pack, take creative risks, and that's the only way you're ever really, I think, going to get to the top. I think without taking risks and making mistakes and being fearless, I think, you know, you're going to be relegated to the realms of mediocrity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. And I want to kind of take you back to how you spoke about you kind of went through this slump. One thing that all freelancers kind of have to think through or consider is really like the stability of the work. Has the uncertainty and lack of stability within freelance photography, has that been something that has really affected you in the past?
Yeah, I mean, you know, being a freelancer is uncertain. You sacrifice a lot. There's no financial security. It's definitely something which is unsettling. I've been a freelancer my whole career at this point, so I think I've become immune to the sense of uncertainty.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, you know, I'm sure it's there. I think I've just learned to live with it, and the sacrifices I've made seem worth it.
I want to kind of move forward now, and I'd love to talk with you about your thoughts on the photography industry as a whole. Where was it when you first started out, and where do you think it is now?
I think the whole industry has been disrupted by technology in a positive way, I must say. Like I'm definitely not an established photographer that is bitter about the fact there is so many more photographers and the conversation has changed and the technology has changed. I mean, you know, the digital proliferation has made photography and images, you know, one of the most accessible and consumed mediums we have as humans. And that makes the photographic landscape right now incredibly interesting. It is the best tool on the planet to communicate. Look at Instagram, you know, which has only really been mainstream for what, like 7 years now or something?
Yeah, 7, 8 years. Well,
a bit recent history. You know, we consume images. Everyone has a camera on their cell phone. I always laugh when I'm like, go to places and they're like, no photography, and you got to hand your camera in if you've got one, but everyone's still allowed to take their phone in.
Yeah.
It's just like, but I've got a camera on my phone.
Exactly, yeah.
Weird thing that happens. But within that digital proliferation, there is just so many voices out there. And I think in every industry, journalism, the commercial industry, advertising industry, it's all changed because, you know, it's not a craft anymore. I think when I started photography, it was still a craft. You know, if you like knew the technology and you could afford the equipment and you knew the technical processes, that was important and valid. And now, you know, you don't need to be a craftsperson anymore. Anyone can make a picture on an iPhone. You know, anyone can buy a new Sony and make good work. And the technology is so good and the files are so good. Even if you don't make work, the post-production that can be done is extraordinary.
Yeah.
So, and this comes back to what I was saying before about that's why the only real currency you have is to differentiate yourself through what you have to say. As an author and as a photographer, it's getting harder to operate. That's for sure. I feel like I have to work a little harder and fight a bit more to get work now. I'm definitely seeing, the editorial market continues to decline incrementally and has been for like the last 15 years. Having said that, I feel very fortunate because I still get very good magazine assignments, but I also find myself wondering how sustainable that is. Like, where am I going to be in 5 years? Like, I'm busy this year, but like, are all those magazines still going to be there in 5 years or still call me in 5 years?
Yeah.
So it's kind of complicated. I think what I've tried to do over the last few years is just kind of diversify my business model more and not be so dependent on editorial work. I think this is, this is the way I think any young photographer has to look at, the landscape now. They have to, have their finger in a couple of different pies. I mean, you have to be a little bit in the academic world, a little bit in the art world, in the commercial world, in the editorial world, and you have to have a career which is much more hybrid than people have, had careers traditionally. Most of my mentors only worked for magazines. They were like magazine photographers.
Yeah.
And I think my generation is, you do a bit of commercial work. You're trying to work on personal projects that you position in the art world.
Yeah.
You are still doing some magazine assignments and you have to, kind of be a bit of everything.
Yeah. I think the idea of working one job or working for one magazine or agency, I suppose, I think those days are definitely gone and you need to definitely have multiple things happening.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I definitely find myself thinking differently now. I think when I started out, I was like, I'm a photographer and I'm going to get people to hire me to be a photographer. Now I actually, that whole thing has flipped on its head and I really think about, what is the story I want to tell? And how do I enable that storytelling?
Yeah.
Who can get behind me to support that work? And where can I draw resources from to create this thing? And that is also branching into like motion and writing and all of it. So
yeah.
I think it's, I think you have to look at concept and how to execute concept more than how do I be a photographer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you also spoke about the future of photography. Is that something that you think about often? And where do you feel it's heading within the commercial and editorial spaces?
I mean, photography itself is only becoming stronger as a medium. I think what's complicated is because everybody can make photographs now, there's a breakdown in the professionalism or the established people who are working as photographers. You see the kind of rise of the influencer movement. 10 years ago, you would have hired a professional advertising photographer to, photograph a campaign for a shoe brand or, some form of luxury brand. And now you see influencers getting hired to make pictures on their iPhones and post because they have a huge following. So there's been a real breakdown in the commercial space and the advertising space like that.
Yeah.
And I hear older photographers whinge about it all the time. And even in the motion space already, motion is that extension of still photography, but it's the same with motion. Like, everyone can produce video now with equipment they can buy for a couple of $1,000s. I mean, you can make beautiful drone footage with a drone that's worth $1,500, where 15 years ago you needed to hire a helicopter.
Yeah.
To make that kind of stuff. So it's just, the landscape is so accessible that you really have to define yourself as somebody that's invested in something. you need to kind of have something to say and are invested in something and bring people to your brand, so to speak, or your ideas.
Yeah. Like you were just talking about with the influencer movement, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see whether that's something that dies out or has an expiry date, or you're going to have to sort of become an influencer to kind of, I don't know, get those jobs or land those projects.
Yeah, I think that will become an increasing part of it.
Because it's sad when you see so many talented photographers today. Like, there's so many people who are really struggling to find work. And then, yeah, you see an influencer or someone who's just really putting out subpar iPhone work or something, getting all the jobs. It's a hard thing to swallow at times.
I mean, it is, but it just kind of is what it is as well. Like, I don't never feel particularly resentful or bitter about it. It's just the state of the world, and it's not just the photography industry that's changing. Obviously, the whole planet is.
Yeah, yeah.
And every industry is somehow affected. I mean, you know, you can even speak to people in finance, and they're bitter about the way the world is changing because they don't make as much money as they used to. It's just, I think the important thing is you have to adapt. Mm. I think, regarding what you said before, Nick, about the future of photography, I do believe it's only becoming more important, and it's an incredibly exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pictures are more important than they ever have been. You know, there's more photographs that have been made. You know, I'm going to make up a statistic here so no one fact check this. But, you know, I'm going to guesstimate that there has been more photos made in the last 5 years and uploaded to, you know, Facebook and Instagram than have ever been made in our entire history as humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes photography a very important medium. I think working as a professional photographer, though, it's becoming more and more boutique to work for a magazine.
Mm.
You know, we haven't really figured out the online business model yet. You know, some organizations have pay walls and whatnot, so they have a subscription-based business model, which has been successful. But the reality is, you know, photography is so accessible. Things are made on much smaller budgets than they used to be.
Mm.
So there's just not the money that there used to be. And again, I'm just kind of going to echo that idea of being a photographer is just not enough. I mean, you have to be an author. You have to have something to contribute to a story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm really glad that you made that point about not just being a photographer but being an author, because it's something I completely agree with. But I want to kind of move us forward because I'm a little bit worried about time today. But I want to ask two more things before we wrap up. And the first thing is regarding headspaces. So something I really love asking people is how they've dealt with particular negative headspaces that they may have had in the past. What are some struggles that you've had in the past, and how have you gone about dealing with them?
Hmm. I think a positive headspace is overrated, to be honest. I don't think that we need to be in a particular creative mood. I always had the preconception that I needed to feel inspired and creative to make my best work. And over the years, I've realized that sometimes you just need to roll your sleeves up and get on with it and make the photographs. And I've had to do that in a number of situations, and the work has been received well and it's been successful. I think it's just part of the human experience to feel down sometimes. I don't think you necessarily have to always be happy. I think some of the best creative vision we've seen come from humanity has been from negative headspaces. Mm. I mean, a lot of the great art, a lot of the great film, it's come from, you know, people with psychological problems or who are depressed. So, you know, I never burden myself with the idea that I have to feel happy and positive to make good work. I think it's just part of the human experience to have bouts of depression, to sometimes feel happy. And I think it's just important to keep focus. I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, negative headspaces can stop you working. And I think the most important thing is, regardless of how you're feeling, is just to keep working.
Yeah.
Because as long as you work, you're gonna make the work. It doesn't really matter how you feel.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So as long as you don't let negative headspaces be debilitating when it comes to, you know, getting out the door and making images or putting your bum in a seat and writing or whatever it is that you do, I think you just roll your sleeves up and keep working.
Yeah. Do you think that at times through your travels and through the various jobs that you've worked in the past, do you think that's given you more of a perspective about how good you really have it? Because it's something that I was thinking about recently. I mean, I need to leave Australia at least once a year just to sort of reset, I suppose. And every time I come back, I always seem to think like how lucky I am and how grateful I am for being where I am. Do you think that your experience through what you photographed in the past has given you better perspective on life?
Yeah, I feel privileged to have seen the more difficult things that I've seen. In some ways, you know, you asked me about how I cope with trauma before and whether it's affected me and all the rest of it. And, you know, in some ways I feel blessed to have seen the difficult things that I've seen because, I mean, they do enrich my understanding of the world. They make me feel grateful for the things that I have, and I often feel grateful to even be alive today. Although, you know, despite all my travels, sometimes I wish I lived on a little island somewhere and I'd never left. There is humility and simplicity, and the world can feel a bit complicated sometimes when you have trudged through so many different realities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose there's going to be quite a few people who are listening to this who might be at university, who might be studying photography or some other creative art, who are thinking, all right, this is all great, but I'd love to get some advice from you now about how to go about moving forward, I suppose. So what are three tips or pieces of advice that you would give passionate photographers who may be starting out today or just finding their feet with creating a freelance business or whatever it be?
I think the first one is to just realize that you're a photographer right now. When I graduated art college, I always had this sense of, you know, one day I'm going to be photographing these incredible things and doing this thing. And, you know, I've got this destination I've got to get to. But really, I mean, you should be photographing whatever it is around you right now. Like if you're into photographing sport, you should be photographing as much sport as you can, you know, whether it's sport on the weekends or, you know, local backyard cricket. Or if you're an artist, you should be making work now. If you're documentarian, you should be photographing your neighborhood or a story in your community. I think it's important to embrace your journey as a storyteller and be working immediately, not think that you're someday going to get a big break and be doing this big thing.
Yeah.
Because it's all these small steps in between that actually get you to that point. And that's getting out the door with a camera and making the images. I mean, that's how you become an experienced storyteller or photographer.
Is there any advice that you'd give photographers about approaching clients or potential editorials with a story they may have shot? How would you suggest photographers should go about doing that?
I think it's important to bring your work to, you know, a certain maturity before you approach people, because, you know, when you meet people that are important or a significant photo editor, you want to make the right impression. You don't want to make the wrong impression too early. So I think you need to be ready.
Yeah,
for those introductions. But I think it's bringing a body of work together. I mean, you know, I often hear photo editors that I interact with in New York, and, you know, they get bombarded by, you know, photographers all the time who can copy that style or make their pictures look like this famous photographer. I mean, you know, everyone can do that now. Everyone can execute the craft.
Mm.
But when they get someone that comes along that has something unique to say and has a vision that is theirs, they notice it.
Yeah.
And they see talent and authenticity. And I think that is, and this again comes back to the thing I've harped on at length about kind of a sense of authorship and having something to say. And I think that's the thing that every young photographer needs to find. I think it's also important to not try and be anyone else. I mean, one of the things that I have seen happen over the last couple of years is this real push for diversity in storytelling. So traditionally there has been established photographers who get assignments, and all of a sudden in the last 2 years, and this is, you know, probably part of the post Me Too conversation, I guess.
Yeah.
There is a real push to have, you know, 50% females being commissioned, and also push, you know, people of color into the landscape, which is very exciting. Because it really means it breaks down these kind of traditional kind of white narratives that we've seen, you know, used over and over again. And yeah. All of a sudden we're getting very interesting, new, dynamic voices who are telling significant stories. And, you know, the narrative about our species is expanding like it should.
Yeah.
So I think when, and not to kind of, you know, ramble here and get too far off the point, but the reason I'm kind of talking about this is I think this is, it's important to acknowledge that this is happening for young photographers, because what it means is they have to kind of choose a story that is relative to them in a way. Like, we have all become our own experts. And, you know, if you're a young gay man, photograph young gay men. I think at this moment in time, it's important to tell things that you are qualified to tell.
Yeah.
But it's a real phenomenon. I think there is a flip side to this, and that is some of the best pieces of art over the years have been made by outsiders. But we do live in a climate right now where, you know, a story about a young black woman has to be told by a young black woman, or a story about a depressed young white man living in suburban America, Australia, has to be told by like a young white man. There's this real kind of, you have to be an expert, or you have to be qualified to tell that story, or kind of have that story ingrained in your identity.
Yeah, you've had to live it.
You have to live it. And we're having a real moment like that where I see that all the time. The people that are getting hired to work on stories, that's just kind of how it is. So I think a young photographer really needs to be aware of that. And, you know, I think if you're a young white man from Western Sydney, you're probably, you know, not going to be a huge success if you go and try and photograph transgender women in India.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then that's an extreme example, but that's kind of the story I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm really glad that you've really touched on this, because the way that I look at it is just like that. I mean, there's so many people out taking photos today in comparison to past years, but there's one thing which another person will never have, and that's your unique perspective on how you see the world around you and how you relate with it. And there's always going to be a story there that's going to be different to anyone else's, because it's you. So, and I think that, like, if you look deep and hard enough at yourself, there is something, or there's a way that you view particular happenings or things that are happening around you that is interesting, and people would like to hear your standpoint on that. So yeah,
I think Nick, you just said it so much better than me.
No, I don't think so, but yeah, it's like I said, I'm really glad that you touched on that, because I hope that that's something which our audience is really taking away from this is yeah, what is your unique standpoint?
Absolutely. Yeah. You just kind of, you nailed it concisely. And it really doesn't matter whether it's a brand or a magazine or what kind of client, like people want to hire a sense of identity and authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I feel like we should probably be wrapping up pretty soon. So I want to take this moment now just to ask you, before we wrap up, where do you want to go moving forward with your photography? Are there any particular ideas or issues that you want to explore?
Nick, that is the golden question. It's a tough question to answer, to be honest. I mean, reconciling where you want to go as a photographer. I mean, I torture myself at length about this question every single day. I think I've definitely hit a point in my career where I feel the constraints of working editorially. My whole career, I've worked for magazines, I've worked on assignment, I've worked on journalism stories, so to speak.
Yep.
And I feel a deep urge to try and transcend that and work on stories that I control. I feel like I've spent my entire career getting an assignment, going out and shooting it, and, like, you know, being kind of told what to say in a way. And I definitely at a point in my life, in my career, I feel like it's time for me to actually speak. And I think that is me focusing more on, like, long-term projects, exhibition and book projects. And that's definitely where I see my future as a photographer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any books in the mix at the moment, or is it just the collection of images from the war stuff that you've got going?
Yeah, I've got kind of two books that are both kind of works in progress. One of the books is the one you just mentioned. It's me kind of stringing together my work in Afghanistan and kind of forming a narrative out of that, which is a slow burn, long-term thing. To be honest, it'll probably be my second book, but I'm also working on a book which, you know, dissects regional identity in Australia. I've done the thing that most photographers do when they get disillusioned in their career, and it's go back to a place of their childhood and try and make sense of it.
Mm.
So over the last few years, I found myself like heading off into the bush in Australia and, you know, photographing these impressions that I kind of knew as a child. It was the places I grew up with when I was like living with grandparents or on holidays with grandparents, areas where my parents are from.
Yeah.
So it's me going back and grappling with a sense of identity and also trying to do something which doesn't fall directly into an editorial story. It's me, you know, responding to a environment through memory.
Yeah.
And making a set of pictures, which is kind of really about an Australia that's kind of slowly kind of drifting off, but is still there in small glimpses.
Yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that portfolio and series once you're finished with it. But look, I want to take this opportunity now to let the audience know that I'm going to have links to everything which me and Adam have spoken about today over at pitchedindustries.com. But Adam, are there any places where you'd like the audience to go to see more of your work or keep up to date with anything that you've got planned for the future?
I don't know. I sound like, you know, when you go and see a band and they like try and sell you the record at the end, I'm about to tell everybody to follow me at adamfergusonstudio.com.
Yeah.
At Adam Ferguson Studio.
This is where you get to plug, you get to plug all your stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best place to follow me for news is really, you know, I guess Instagram and website.
Yeah. Sweet. So I'll have both those links in the show notes as well as over at pitchedindustries.com. But Adam, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I know that you're such a busy man, so I really do appreciate you coming on the show and giving our audience so much awesome advice. So thank you very much.
Nick, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And, you know, grateful that you're interested in my career. And I hope this is interesting to some aspiring photographers out there.
So that's about it for today, guys. Thank you so much for listening, like always, and I hope that you were able to take away a few things from our conversation today. If you haven't already, could you please, like always, subscribe to this podcast and head over to the Pitched Industries Instagram feed to keep in the loop with any articles that I'll be posting, as well as a whole heap of other stuff. Also, if you are interested in finding out 13 quick ways that you can sell and market your work as a freelance photographer or artist, head to pitchedindustries.com where you can download a quick PDF that I've made for free that will surely give you a few ideas. Also, I will put the link in the show notes, so have a quick look there as well. So anyway, guys, I am looking forward to chatting with you guys next time. But until then, I hope you have a good week and I'll catch you next time. Cheers.